Hello, everyone. I'm Drew.
I'm Bailey.
I'm Lacey.
And we're Sarcastics. Let's get sinister. Bailey has a review she wants to share.
Pat is angry. So I finally watched The Woman in the Yard. It's not good. It's not my
thing.
No. So kind of like how the trailer like makes it seem like you're kind of like guessing like who the woman is, like what happened and everything. There's a lot of like psychological stuff. Like you think something's happening and then like it's her mind messing with her or something. The ending is trash. It's so trash.
That's annoying. I hate that.
They like try to make it have like a moral, like it's so dumb. I don't want to like, I won't spoil it for our listeners. If you guys want me to like tell you what the ending is like afterwards, I will. Yeah.
Well, that's a bummer. It looked like a good one.
Yeah, and like so, I watched it in a few parts, like because I worked Wednesday through like Saturday. And two of the shifts were like overnights and we had like some hours that like we weren't doing anything. So I was like watching it in like a few parts and like up until like the end of my Saturday shift, I was like, this seems like interesting. Like I can't wait to like figure out the plot and like get some answers and everything. And then the last like 20 minutes just like ruined it.
That sucks.
I know. So. Turns out my theory was wrong. I thought it was somehow the mom and like kind of like if you've ever seen like the others, how they like they don't know that they're dead. I thought it was like sort of like around that kind of idea almost. No.
I thought it was like a metaphor for grief.
It sort of is.
Sorry, I had to mute because my dogs are barking.
We're just taking a dramatic pause.
I'm just thinking really hard.
I mean, again, like, I can totally spoil it for you guys. I don't recommend you waste your time watching it because it was just very disappointing.
I want to see, have either one of you seen Weapons yet?
No.
The one with the kids that disappear from the classroom or whatever?
No.
That one looked good.
So I have this habit of, so I don't like sit down and watch a lot of movies for myself because I don't have a lot of time when my kids are asleep. And a lot of the time at the end of the day, I'm just too tired. I want to put something on just for the noise and I don't have the energy to actually pay attention. So what my habit is that I'll like watch clips on TikTok and kind of just fill in the blanks for myself. So that's what I've done with the Weapons movie. And if I have any questions, I'll, like, look it up.
Well, that's a fun way to halfway write your own movie.
She'll never be disappointed, though.
Yeah.
That's true.
I do want to see the new Conjuring.
I'm not ready to move quite off of Weapons yet. It's based on a true story, isn't it?
Oh, I don't know.
Oh, I thought it was.
I just know that trailer I've seen of it, which I think probably were sent to me by you, have all looked spooky. So
yeah, I think that maybe it was like,
no, it's not.
Okay, I was going to say
I've seen children.
Then I'm going to stop talking about it.
It was inspired by personal experiences and real life grief, including the loss of the director's best friend, Trevor.
Oh, Trevor. So, anything else? Any other business? No? Okay, so, listeners.
Doing something new this week.
What are we doing new this week?
Well, hold on, Lacey. Is it the 44 or is it 94?
94. But that's my old email. I don't know. Hold on. It's okay. It's just that one was so full it doesn't always get emails. Let me just make sure I've got space for it to come through.
what? Delete your email.
Yeah, right?
No, my email, it's not that my email's full, it's that my whole Google account connected to that email is full. Like, between my email, my drive, my pictures, and everything. Like, delete the storage of my whole... I have deleted so many things. It's like, I don't know what's still taking up space there, because I made a new email after I got married and changed my name. But it is, yeah. Emails will stop on October 5th. Okay, I have time. Email me.
Okay.
What's happening?
So,
you never the filled new up your thing, email? It's really annoying.
No.
The thing that we're doing this week as like a fun little thing, way for us to have fun, is I wrote this case up, and I don't think Lacey or Bailey know the case. But what I've done is I've sent the write-up to Lacey, and she's going to be reading it for everybody. In real time, she's going to learn about it as she reads it.
I feel, so this is me looking on the bad side of it. I feel like this is going to trigger more interruptions from you, because she's not going to read it the way you want it read.
I disagree. I don't know how she could possibly screw it up.
I'm sure I can find a way.
Back when we got this idea, that's why I was like, and so I think Lacey was like, oh, this could be fun. And I was like, no.
I don't know how she would read it in a way that I'd be like, Lacey, you're doing it.
We're going to find out.
Yeah, I really don't think.
The name looks familiar to me, and I think I might have actually put this name on like my own list of see if I want to write about these things in the future. Mm. So I might, as I start reading, I might know some of it if I did like a shallow dive into them.
Okay.
But it's definitely not something that I know in detail. So I'll be learning alongside you guys.
Well, shallow dive.
Yeah.
That, you know.
You're not supposed to do that, Lacey. You're going to break your neck.
Oh.
Or your head.
Oh, well.
There's no diving.
Fine.
All right, so Lacey, why don't you tell us what we're talking about this week?
All right, I'm going to tell you guys about Stephen Powell. Huh?
Why do I recognize this name?
I don't know.
I also recognize the name. The name is Susan Powell. Oh, I was there. Okay, hold on. I have to read. I forgot.
You were there when she went missing?
No. Okay. Are we ready to start?
Break in the case!
Lacey! Yes.
Susan Marie Cox was born October 16, 1981, in Alamogordo, New Mexico, to Chuck and Judy Cox. Brandon and I were in Alamogordo when we were doing one of our national parks trip. Brandon has a shirt with, like, the local high school, it's like Alamogordo Tigers or something, that he got in Walmart. Anyway, that was cool.
So I didn't need to include that, like, how to pronounce
No,
that.
But good job.
Yeah, well, I'm looking
out for you, bud. That was very kind of you.
It doesn't come up again.
Okay. She's a Libra.
Yes.
I researched what traits Libras usually have, and I copied a few that I think describe Susan well. Libras are cooperative and social, but avoid confrontations. Libras like harmony and gentleness and dislike violence and injustice. Susan grew up the third of four children in a loving, tight-knit, devout Mormon family in Puyallup, Washington. Now, I would not have known how to say that if you didn't give me the pronunciation, so thank you.
You're welcome. That comes up later, so remember.
Puyallup. As a teenager, she was known to be friendly, social, and somewhat independent-minded, though her faith remained very important to her. As a student, she was focused and a hard worker. Her dream was to have a strong, stable family of her own. She loved decorating, scrapbooking, and homemaking skills, which she later carried over into her adult life. As an adult, friends and family described Susan as bubbly, outgoing, and kind.
What after are high homemaking school, skills?
Hmm?
What are cleaning, home cooking? Making?
Yeah, they like sewing. Cooking, cleaning, sewing, child rearing.
Oh, she's you know, really good at that.
Keeping a happy home.
Oh.
Cleaning your husband. School,
having the martinis ready for your husband when you go home?
Yes.
Got it.
Susan briefly studied cosmetology and bounced around in various jobs. Her main goal continued to be to get married and have children. To achieve this goal, in the early 2000s, when Susan was 18, 19 years old, she attended a kind of singles event held by her church. So, in the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, they often have single wards. Singles wards. These are for unmarried adults, typically between the ages of 18 and 30. In addition to their normal Sunday meetings, members of a singles ward get together during the week for extra activities. The specific activities depend on the individual congregation, but you might see talent shows. I'm coming back to that. Sports leagues, barbecues, movie nights, etc. One of the biggest parts of the singles ward's social scene is dating. These congregations give people a chance to meet those with similar values and interests. And in late 2000, Susan attended these events. And met Joshua Powell. So I just want to pop back to talent shows. Imagine joining a single group because you want to meet the love of your life and find out you have to do a fucking talent show. That's all. That's all I had to say about it.
Yeah, but it's think of the story.
You don't want to marry someone who's untalented, Lacey.
That's true. Joshua Powell was born January 20th, 1976. And Puyallup, Washington, to Stephen and Terica Powell. So he was born 76, she was 81. Josh was born on the cusp between Aquarius and Capricorn, so I think that means he displays traits from both. Guesses.
We're so into it.
Do you think it's Aquariuses or Aquarii?
You're the English teacher.
Are independent, but temperamental and uncompromising. They like risky business, but dislike limitations and broken promises. Capricorns can be responsible and disciplined, but also condescending and unforgiving. They like family and tradition. There's a bit of a negative spin here on Joshua's traits.
I was gonna say, Pat's my husband's a Capricorn.
Yeah.
What I did was I read personality traits, and then I was like, oh, that fits Susan, or oh, that fits Josh. If you're interpreting the traits as negative for Josh, that's not my fault.
I mean, condescending and unforgiving. It's hard to put a...
They're not really condescending.
I'm saying it more positively.
They can be critical.
Lacey, try saying it in a more positive way.
He was also condescending and unforgiving.
Great!
Oh, sounds amazing.
Never mind, I won't be suspicious of Joshua.
He sounds like a great guy.
He was one of five children, so she was one of four, I think. Yeah, she was one of four. He was one of five children in a chaotic and dysfunctional family.
They're Mormons,
Steve Powell
aren't they?
Was domineering, obsessive, and openly hostile toward Terica. Over time, he became increasingly more critical and dismissive of the Latter-day Saints Church, while Terica remained devoted to it. Their household was described as volatile and unstable. As a child and teen, Joshua struggled socially and academically, although he was intelligent and skilled with computers. His siblings later said they were often afraid of him. He was controlling, manipulative, volatile, and cruel at times. Although Joshua had a strained relationship with his father, he appeared to inherit many of Steve's attitudes, particularly a sense of entitlement, a tendency toward manipulation, and the objectification of women. Oh no.
He sounds wonderful.
I'm worried about Susan. In 1992, Terica filed for divorce from Steve. Good Terica. This was a big deal, considering how devoted to the church Terica was. In the Latter-day Saints religion, the sanctity of marriage and families is taught repeatedly in the scriptures. This is direct from the Church of Jesus Christ website. Because the family is central to Heavenly Father's plan for his children, Satan seeks to destroy marriages and families. Because of the poor choices and selfishness of one or both marriage partners, marriages sometimes end in contention, separation, and divorce. If, instead of resorting to divorce, each individual will seek the comfort and well-being of his or her spouse, couples will grow in love and unity. The gospel of Jesus Christ, including repentance, forgiveness, integrity, and love, provides the remedy for conflict in marriage. So the fact that Terica filed for divorce was significant. I like the idea that if your marriage is going really badly, turn to your spouse.
Mm-hmm. Also, it's your own fault.
Yeah. If you're screwing up your marriage, turn to your spouse.
Well, you have to depend on each other.
If your spouse is abusive and mean to you, turn to him.
Oh, is that them? I just looked at the pictures you had up. Is that Susan and Joshua?
Yes.
She's pretty.
She is. What do you think of Josh?
Less.
He kind of looks like a stereotypical trailer park man dude.
Okay.
This divorce lasted years and was acrimonious to say the least. Good word. The divorce involved allegations.
What does acrimonious mean?
Not
good.
yeah, not friendly. The divorce involved allegations of mental unfitness, pornography, polygamy, and even witchcraft.
What?
Yeah. In her documents, Terica wrote that Joshua once tried to commit suicide when he was 13 to 14 years old, and he also threatened her with a butcher knife. We're not going to learn more about the polygamy and witchcraft, I don't think. That's a bummer.
No.
The butcher knife incident.
We will.
Good. Can you still, like, divorce someone for witchcraft?
For witchcraft. Well, did they disclose the witchcraft before you were married?
Because if so, like, if I ever were to get divorced, I want that to be the reason.
Pat is into witches.
Or do you want it to be that you...
I want to be into witchcraft, and okay. It was too bad for him.
And Pat's like, you know what? Divorce.
Yeah.
Lacey, the way I wrote it up is, so the first one was, like, unfitness or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
The first section is, like, describing what that had to do. And then so you'll say, keep going. You're doing great. You're reading it perfectly. I would just minimize the yawns.
Sorry. They just come on.
Remember how I said, like, you just correcting her?
Go ahead, Lacey.
The butcher knife incident, Terica wrote, was the result of her asking her son to do the dishes. That feels like an overreaction. On other occasions, he and one of his brothers pushed and hit her, she wrote. She claimed her boys had been corrupted by their father. How infuriating would it be not only to be married to somebody who's abusive, but then, like, to watch your children turn into that person?
I would be pissed.
I mean, I like to think I would get out before that happened, but I haven't been there. So. In documents filed by Steve, he claimed his wife, who studied herbs and natural healing, had mixed a New Age mysticism with Mormon beliefs in a way that amounted to practicing witchcraft and devil worship.
Ooh.
So she used herbs sometimes.
She just She's seasoned the chicken and that was too much.
I bet she used essential oil and he was like,
She burned a candle inside the house and it was too much.
And it smelled nice and he was like, no, no, no. In response, Terica claimed Steve collected books on the occult and had a strong interest in pornography, which he had shared with their son. So she's the witch and he's got the devil and porn.
They go hand in hand, Lacey.
They should be getting along better. Terica told the court she believed her husband needed serious medical help due to some underlying problem, and she thought their older boys would benefit from counseling too, to undo that faulty thinking that had been established in them by their father. At one point, Terica said, Steve proclaimed he had a right to take another wife and had his eye on a woman who was already married, writing a song about her and detailing sexual fantasies in his journal. I would like to throw out there that if you're Mormon and you marry a Mormon man, I don't think you'd be too surprised if that Mormon man decides he wants to be Mormon and have another wife.
Okay.
I mean, you don't have to like it, but, like, can you be surprised when it happens? I don't know.
Was that in your script, Lacey, or is that you going off?
No, that was me.
Okay. Mormon.
Terica told the court that Steve would ignore certain behaviors of their children and then suddenly turn on them more violently than was necessary. This would result in yelling, name-calling, and spanking that was too forceful and too long. She said Josh, in particular, received overly harsh discipline at the hands of his father. Steve admitted Josh was difficult, claiming that because he was independent, working out, and getting taller, he was getting harder to control. Terica said she believed her son's difficulties were due to not knowing where the boundaries are and what is acceptable behavior. Fair. These difficulties she blamed on Steve. I think that's valid. That makes sense. Terica claimed her husband steadily turned their sons against her, dividing the family. She told the court there were times she was genuinely afraid of Steve and the boys. At one time, she had asked Josh to show her more respect, and he responded by saying, "You have to earn respect, Mom. What have you done to earn my respect?"
Ooh. That would be a backhand.
Ooh, yeah. Never mind. I should just keep going. I wonder why that all worked out that way.
I think the youngest daughter, because she was 7, mm-hmm. the court said, you're going to go live with Mom because you're a better parent. And then the boys were old enough to say, we want to live with Dad.
Yeah, that made sense to me. I just wonder why the daughter ended up going to her father a couple years later. So was it all boys and one daughter?
No, there were 5 kids. I think the oldest was 18 at the time. And she's... Okay. She
She didn't need to be custodied because she was 18.
Right. And yeah. towards the, I don't know, I don't know for sure who she was, but I think based on later stuff, and who the children seem to side with, I think the oldest name is Jennifer and the youngest daughter is Alina or something like that. A-L-I-N-A.
Okay.
And she seems to have a lot of sympathy and like for her dad.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah.
Okay. After high school, Josh attended college off and on, studying business and computer science, but he had trouble finishing programs and keeping steady work. When he was about 24 years old, he met Susan Cox at the singles wards. To Susan, Joshua appeared charming and a promising match. He was a member of the church, he was educated, and he seemed attentive. He seemed like the kind of man who could help her build the family life she dreamed of. Shortly after meeting, I think they met in November 2000, in April 2001, they married in the Portland, Oregon LDS Temple when Susan was 19 and Joshua 25. So they met in November and married in April, like the next April they ran into.
6 months later, yeah. I don't think that it, like, I didn't see anything that expressly said it, but I don't think anyone really... I feel as though Susan really wanted to get married and have kids. And she, so to do that, she kind of rushed into things.
Yeah, I could see that.
And she kind of lowered her standards.
Mm-hmm. She started dating a guy and he seemed nice and she's like, okay, let's go.
Yeah. She seemed like he seemed like a great match because he had baby making material.
Yeah, it wouldn't be the first time. But, in the first 5 years of their marriage, they lived in Washington, moving around a lot to different apartments and houses due to financial instability. For a brief period following their wedding, the couple actually lived with Steve Powell. Josh struggled with steady employment. He worked various jobs in computer programming, sales, and later real estate, but often quit or ran into financial issues. Meanwhile, Susan worked in cosmetology for a time, but later took office jobs to help support the family. She was known for being frugal, resourceful, and hardworking, often holding the household together financially. Susan would work steadily and didn't like taking financial risks, whereas Josh would jump from venture to venture somewhat erratically. This difference caused friction between the two. To outsiders, they seemed like a typical young LDS couple, married in the temple, active in church, and social in their singles ward community. They were often described as friendly and charming, attending church functions and social gatherings together. However, Josh showed early signs of control and dominance. He made most of the financial decisions for the two. He pressured Susan to adhere to strict expectations, including church activities, household routines, and social interactions. Those around them started noticing subtle condescension toward Susan as well. Gradually, Josh began isolating Susan from her friends and family. Susan, wanting to maintain peace and follow LDS expectations, remained compliant to her husband. Finally, after bouncing around Washington for about 4 years, they relocated to West Valley City, Utah, a suburb of Salt Lake City. On January 19, 2005, Susan gave birth to the couple's first child, Charles Joshua Powell. After his birth, Susan became more focused on childcare in the household rather than work. She continued to work, however, as a cosmetologist and doing the office jobs to help support the household, but her priorities shifted hard onto raising Charlie. Meanwhile, Joshua worked sporadically in IT and computer jobs. He became more controlling and erratic. He would assert authority over finances. He seemed to become frustrated with Susan because she was spending more time focused on Charlie than helping him with business ventures. The birth of her child intensified the financial stress on the couple, with medical bills, childcare costs, and household expenses increasing. It was also around this time that Joshua started gambling, cool, which wasn't too financially damaging to the household, but certainly didn't help.
I like, real quick, I liked your quick little comment there, Lacey. That was very nice. And then I like how animated Bailey is getting. And you said something about gambling. She's like, the fuck?
No, I can't see her. I'm reading.
You should work more because we need more money, but I'm going to go gamble. And also, don't spend much time with your son.
Remember how I said that, like, I think it was one of his horoscopes that, like, risk-taking?
Yeah.
Yeah. He's really into risks.
Look at that baby.
Yeah, that's Charlie.
Tension between Susan and Joshua increased as well. Susan was often exhausted and felt isolated, while Josh remained largely focused on his ambitions and dismissive of Susan's concerns. Not finding what she needed from her husband, Susan turned to her parents for emotional support. She confided in them about her struggles with the financial stress, Josh's controlling behavior, and feeling isolated from her loved ones. Her parents were loving and attentive, but they were also living over 800 miles away. Josh was often irritated and defensive whenever Susan's family tried to offer advice or get involved. This was partly fueled by embarrassment over his financial instability, but also his own personality and how he didn't like having his authority challenged. Throughout 2006, Josh continued to bounce between jobs while the household mainly relied on Susan's income. Friends and family began noticing that Josh was gambling in secret. Was it in secret if they were all noticing?
Fair. I think that I meant more like he was keeping things from Susan.
Also, he's embarrassed about the financial instability. Stop fucking gambling.
Bailey, you gotta risk it to get the biscuit.
Jesus Christ.
You're chasing that biscuit. On January 2nd, 2007, Susan gave birth to the couple's second child. Oh, sure. Let's bring another one in.
Braden, she wants Timothy a family, Howard. Lacey.
Okay, well. Okay. Well, they're
cute. I don't think Susan should be punished for anything. She's doing what she's supposed to do.
Yeah. I mean, I don't want bad things for Susan.
She's also doing what she wanted. She wanted to be married. She wanted to have a family. But, like, she chose the wrong person.
Yeah. As you can imagine, everything worsened. That was not my input. That was not mine. That was from the script. Susan's responsibilities grew, and Josh's control intensified. Josh dictated household decisions, spending, and how Susan spent her time. He frequently criticized Susan's parenting and decisions, sometimes subtly, sometimes aggressively. Josh continued to bounce between jobs and struggled with debt. He filed for bankruptcy this year, declaring $200,000 in debt. This declaration erased some debt, but severely impacted his credit. Tension continued to grow between the two due to financial mishaps and Josh's gambling. Yes, Bailey.
How much parenting was he doing? And he's gonna, like, come at her? Like, fuck you.
Sorry. I think that he was embarrassed by the fact that she was able to wear so many hats.
And pants. She's also wearing all the pants. So.
Yes. And so that's
why she's wearing all the clothing.
That's he's why just naked and angry.
That's why he took control of the finances, because he was like, I need some kind of control.
Yeah.
Also, I think he did that so that she wouldn't know about the gambling. Yeah. And then I think he tried to, like, criticize her and lower her self, like, self-worth as much as he could, because she was doing so good.
Classic.
And he is not a good person.
There's a note here from our author. It says, I'd be so pissed if my husband was insisting on being the authority over our finances, but was so irresponsible with money. Plus, he's not holding a steady job, and we're relying on my income for all of this. I agree with the author.
Mm-hmm. He's using my money to be terrible.
Yeah,
I don't... These relationships make me so mad, because, like, I just want to...
Shake her?
No, I want to fucking hit him.
Yeah, I'd like both of those.
Because, like, if for instance, my husband tried to talk to me like that, he'd be fucking on the floor. Lovingly. But, like, fuck you.
Yeah. Well, you're really going to like this next paragraph.
Great.
Susan,
you're not allowed to read ahead.
I'm skimming. We paused for a while. Susan continued to become more and more isolated from family
when
and friends.
When your actors go rogue.
I know.
There's no improv, Lacey.
A pattern began to emerge where Josh, in an effort to control the family, began undermining Susan. Susan would put the boys to bed and Joshua would get them up again, saying such things as, Mommy is so mean. He is so desperate to be the head of the household that he's doing all kinds of stupid shit.
Does he know what a fucking routine is? Like, Jesus Christ.
Oh my god, if you're upset about that, just wait, Bailey.
By 2008, Susan had confided in friends and family that she was considering divorce.
Good.
She was feeling trapped and wanted out, but she was afraid due to the LDS emphasis on marriage and family. So she began documenting her concerns in a journal. Over the course of their marriage, Susan noted in her journal that Josh started to withdraw from their religion. He began refusing to attend church with his family. In February 2008, Josh had Susan open a HELOC on their home for around $54,000. Oh, you're going to explain it. I was like, I don't know what that means.
Okay.
HELOC stands for Home Equity Line of Credit. Oh, I did know what that means. Basically, a loan that uses the value of a house as collateral. It works like a credit card. You can borrow money up to a certain limit and pay it back over time. So they were approved for around $54,000, and Josh began to use that money to mostly cover ongoing expenses and gambling debt. At the end of, well, at least it says covering gambling debt rather than covering new gambling.
Yeah, you get rid of debt so you can gamble more.
That's true. I would like to quickly say, I think I'd left put a typo in there when I said that they got approved for $54,000. Remember how Josh filed for bankruptcy and tanked his credit? Okay. And then he had Susan take out the HELOC loan.
She got approved.
Yes.
At the end of June 2008, Susan recorded a video documenting property damage she attributed to Josh, and she wrote a secret will that included the statements, "I want it documented that there is extreme turmoil in our marriage, and if I die, it may not be an accident, even if it looks like one." She also wrote that it is an open fact that we have life insurance policies of over $1 million if we die in the next 4 years. I feel like if you're at the point in your marriage where you have to put stuff like that in like a secret will, get out of that marriage.
Yeah.
Like if you can. Because at that
point, it's a bit of a red flag.
You can't, but yeah. If you think you're, because at that point, you think your husband might kill you. Go away. Okay. In February 2009, they'd almost used the full amount available on their... Didn't they get it in February 2008? Oh my god, they used almost I'm willing to bet. Almost $54,000 in a year.
He was
they were financially maxed out. Susan was increasingly leaning on her parents, while Josh became more secretive and resentful. In the spring and summer, Susan started...
What does he have to be resentful of?
He didn't like Susan's parents butting in on his marriage.
Well, maybe he shouldn't run their finances into the ground and make his wife work crazy hours while raising two kids.
Susan started discussing her interest in divorce with friends, co-workers, and church members. So she's really talking to everybody like, I want to leave my husband so bad. I think he might kill me. Susan. I'm worried because this episode is her name. She began organizing important documents and updating her will. I don't remember what I learned about her when I put her on my list.
Maybe, Lacey, maybe she gets out of it. Maybe, like, it's a good, like, maybe she's a survivor. Maybe she kills
him and we're all like, I was gonna say, or maybe it's a twist and she actually gets fed up and murders him.
Yeah.
Okay.
In the fall, friends and neighbors reported that arguments between Susan and Josh became more frequent and intense. Josh had grown hostile toward the LDS church and didn't like Susan staying active in the church. I think control. Susan confided to friends that if anything ever happened to her, quote, it would be Josh, describing their financial instability and Josh's temper.
Another conversation you shouldn't be having with your friends.
If what one are of her friends told me, saying? If one of you told me that you thought your husband might murder you, I would be like, please, please leave the house.
I would go and pick you up and kidnap you.
Yeah, like, come over, come hang out with me for a little bit. Just don't tell him you're coming here, but, like, come over. In June 2009, Josh took out a New York life insurance policy on Susan worth about $1 million and $250,000 each for Charlie and Braden. Oh, no.
Dear Lord.
What?
Okay. November 2009, Susan wrote and hid a letter with her will that stated she feared for her life and explicitly named Josh as a threat. Susan was trying to maintain appearances for her children, but based on conversations they'd had with her, friends believed Susan was resigned that her marriage was broken. On the morning of December 6, 2009, Susan and her boys went to church. Friends at church said Susan appeared tired but normal. Following the services, Susan skipped her choir practice, which was unusual for her. That evening, a neighbor, Giovanna Owings, visited the household for dinner, leaving at around 5 p.m. Josh had prepared pancakes for his family and Giovanna. Giovanna later recalled that Susan seemed to get tired after eating the meal. This was the last time Susan was seen by someone outside the Powell household.
Sometimes after Giovanna left, so sad.
Susan called a co-worker, leaving a voicemail saying she wouldn't be coming to work the following day. This was another unusual act by Susan, who rarely missed work. The rest of the evening is according to Josh. He took the boys sledding at around 5:30 p.m., arriving home around 8. At around 11:45 p.m., several neighbors reported hearing the car alarm to the family vehicle. This was because, according to Josh, he decided to have a spontaneous overnight camping trip with his boys 2 hours away from home. This was bizarre, because it was a Sunday night, so a school night, at 11:45. Also, it was freezing outside. It was freaking December. Weather records say that at 6 p.m. on December 6, 2009, it was overcast with a high of 21 and a low of 16 degrees Fahrenheit with a snowstorm in the forecast. According to Josh, Susan didn't go because she was too tired. Josh said he left with the boys, who were almost 5 and 3 at this point, sometime between midnight and 1 a.m., and took them camping in Simpson Springs in the West Desert. What the fuck?
Oh my God.
Remember when you were upset about his routines?
I hope we get a sassy cop that's investigating this being like, what? Like, so what's your thought process coming up with this plan?
Yeah, I'm sure spontaneous. This is just a crappy cover story, but it is such a crappy cover story. But it also feels like a believable thing he would do.
Because he sucks?
He sucks and seems so out of tune with, like, how to be with children. The following day, December 7th, Susan didn't show up for work, which she left the voicemail for a coworker, so not too surprising, but Susan was extremely reliable. Even if she called out, she would usually follow up with coworkers. On December 7th, when she didn't show and didn't respond to any messages or calls, it raised suspicion amongst her coworkers. Additionally, Susan never dropped off the boys at daycare on December 7th.
I just realized that I used that date so much in that paragraph.
You're really driving home what? On December 7th.
What day is it again?
December 7th.
Oh.
Her daycare provider, Debbie Caldwell, tried to contact her but was unable to. Debbie, becoming concerned, notified the emergency contact, Terica. The daycare was a small, home-based facility that was licensed for 8 children. Like Lacey's daycare. They have more than 8 there.
I know, but like...
But it's a small home-based facility. Yeah,
I was thinking how, like, if I didn't show up with my kids to daycare, I don't think my daycare would be, like, too worried to the point where they would call people.
Yeah, I think mine would probably call Brandon and be like, where's the baby?
Yeah.
And what day was this again?
December 7th.
Monday, December 7th.
It's also the date of Pearl Harbor.
Oh, never forget. Terica was unsuccessful in getting into contact with Josh. Don't make me laugh about Pearl Harbor. That's disrespectful. I didn't mean to. That wasn't my fault. Terica was unsuccessful in getting into contact with Josh or Susan, so she and Josh's sister, Jennifer Graves, headed to their home. While en route, they contacted the police, requested a welfare check. Yeah, I feel like for people to be taking this many... People are suspicious already, I think, for it to just be like she's not answering coworkers' calls and she didn't take the kids to daycare. And now they're like, call the police. We're all going to check on her. Like, they're already suspicious.
Well, to be fair, it wasn't just Susan that they were worried about because they couldn't get in touch with Josh either.
Oh, that's true. To say Terica couldn't get him. Okay. So they are thinking no adults in the house are answering the phone. Okay.
Yeah, they're thinking, did they all die?
Yeah. Officers from the West Valley City Police Department arrived at the Powell home in the early afternoon, but no one answered when they knocked on the door. The house was locked, and there appeared to be no signs of forced entry. Eventually, the police gained entry into the home. I saw some reports saying a relative unlocked the door, or a landlord, but some reports say the police broke a window. Either way, they entered the home for fear that the family may be unconscious inside due to carbon monoxide poisoning.
Real quick, here's a picture.
Yeah.
And you see that window there that has, like, the cardboard?
Mm-hmm.
I found this in, like, the evidence stuff, and I'm pretty sure they broke that window to get in.
Okay.
So I think that they broke a window to get in.
So, just for my knowledge and maybe for anyone else, when you call a welfare check on someone, like, to what extent do the police, like, go? Like, do they have to see you? Or if, like, no one answered the door,
I don't know,
like,
but
they just leave?
I wonder if they have permission, if, like, there was a landlord, or maybe, I don't know why his mom would be able to give permission, but I wonder if because there were other people there who were related, if they were somehow able to...
So, from what I understand working in EMS, when a welfare check is called, it's because they genuinely think something is wrong. So that kind of gives us, like, we need to put eyes on the patient and make sure that they're okay. Because, like...
So that gives, like, the cops, like, reasonable doubt to, like, or, like, reasonable evidence to, like, make entry into a home?
Probable cause?
Yeah.
I think so. I think also that Terica and his sister were on scene and said, like, nobody's been able... Like, we haven't heard from them in over a day.
And the fact that there were kids, too, I think probably... Yeah. Up the concern.
Like, I mean, I didn't mention it, but Josh also didn't go to work on Monday. So, like, neither of them went to work. The kids didn't go to school. Nobody's answering their phone.
Like, I mean, you did put in here they were worried about, like, carbon monoxide poisoning or something. It does sound like... I could even see a member of the family being like, well, if you guys aren't gonna go in, I'm gonna fucking get in.
Yeah.
You know. Alright.
Tell us what happened once they got inside.
I'm going to tell you. Inside the home, police found Susan's purse with her wallet and keys in the master bedroom located near a rug doctor. They found food left out in the kitchen, so it looked like someone was preparing a meal that was never finished. The family minivan was not in the garage, but the most chilling discovery was in the living room. The couch was wet, and two box fans were running on high, aimed right at it. The floor and carpet near the couch appeared to have been stained as well. At this point, the officer began treating the home as suspicious. They didn't declare it a crime scene yet, but they were careful not to disturb potential evidence. That's a nice change from some of these cases we read, where they just invite the neighborhood to come trample over potential evidence.
Well, to be fair, the last few ones we've had were, like, old-timey ones where they didn't know.
This is 2009.
Staked out the house, waiting for anyone to return. They continually called Susan and Josh's phones with no response. Their cell phones were both off or out of service for much of the day. They contacted friends, family, neighbors, coworkers to see if anyone had seen or heard from the family. They started collecting background information on the family, including financial history, marital struggles, and Josh's personal history, i.e. gambling. Meanwhile, at 3:02 p.m., Giovanna Owings' son finally got hold of Josh. He told Josh that Susan had not gone to work and police were at their home. Cell tower records later revealed Josh Powell was in West Valley City at the time he received that phone call. He then drove about 30 miles south to Lehigh, where he called Susan Powell's phone and left a voicemail, stating he was on his way home from a camping trip. Josh was unaccounted for over the next 2 hours. His next contact occurred at about 5:30 p.m., where he again called Susan's phone and left another message. Josh said he was waiting for Susan outside her office, as if he planned to pick her up and take her home. So, okay. Next two lines, and then Josh finally showed up at home around 6:40 to 7 p.m. He just casually drove their minivan into the driveway with Charlie and Braden in the back seat. So somebody got a hold of him
at 3.
He was like, "Oh, I'm on a camping trip," but cell phone shows that he was actually in town. And then he drove 30 miles away, called her phone and left a voicemail, hid for 2 hours, and then called and was like, "I'm at your office, waiting to pick you up." Wow, it almost seems like he's setting up an alibi.
Trying to.
Yeah, and he's doing it so poorly. His demeanor stood out immediately. He appeared calm and detached, showing little concern about Susan's absence. He can't even pretend to be worried. He told police and family that he had taken the boys on an overnight camping trip in the West Desert, leaving after midnight the night before. The police, understandably, had questions. When did he leave? Where exactly did they camp? How'd they manage the freezing temperatures overnight? What's up with the blood on the floor near the wet couch? Josh's answers were vague and inconsistent, and his lack of urgency was alarming to the officers. There's good writing in here. Josh claimed that Susan had cut herself minorly while doing household chores. He said the couch had just been cleaned, which explained the fans blowing on it. I, too, like to soak my couch when I clean it. He told police he took the boys camping because he wanted to try out his new generator. The urge came middle on
in the
night.
In the middle of the desert?
Yes. That's what? A good place. That's a good place. There's no light stuff. Though initially suspicious, police turned the home over to Josh after he promised to meet detectives for follow-up interviews. That night, a neighbor reported that around 11 p.m., Josh pulled the minivan partway out of the garage, then spent 10 to 15 minutes walking around the van, going in and out of the house and opening all the different doors of the van. The following morning, Josh missed his interview appointment with the lead detective.
Does he know he has neighbors?
Does he know that, like, he needs to do things to keep up the pretense? He didn't go to talk to the cops the next day. His sister, Jennifer, arrived at the Powell house and found her brother cleaning. Jennifer told police that Josh was in the garage and there was, quote, a lot of water on the floor and it looked like there was some sawdust mixed in with the water. Josh finally arrived at West Valley City Police headquarters after 12:30 p.m., more than 3 hours late. At the same time, Jennifer took Charlie and Braden to the Salt Lake County Children's Justice Center. At the Justice Center, Charlie and Braden confirmed their father's camping story. Charlie told a detective that his mother had gone camping with him on Sunday, but she'd stayed behind at the campsite where the crystals are for some reason and did not return with them. Josh later denied this. In just under a week, detectives were referring in search warrants to this case as an investigation into unlawful detention, kidnapping, and/or homicide. They started interviewing neighbors, friends, and co-workers about Susan's disappearance. Three different co-workers told police that Susan had told them that if anything were to happen to her, that they were to give police a file that she had hidden from her husband. Did she hide it successfully? Okay, hold on. Josh's co-workers told investigators they'd heard comments from Josh about how to kill someone, dispose of the body, and not get caught. What a fucking weirdo. More co-workers told police that at a company Christmas party, Josh told them that in order to get away with murder, he would hide a body in a mine shaft in the West Desert of Utah.
It's Christmas. Where does this story come from?
Why is he talking to all these people about killing people and disposing of bodies?
God.
And at her work Christmas party, right? He doesn't have co-workers. He doesn't work.
No, it does
say Josh's co-workers. Okay.
Yeah, he does have a job. At
her work's Christmas party talking about killing people.
No.
But at the same time, like, so if that happened, her coworkers are hearing from her. If anything happens to me, there's this file. No one would be like, can you leave him?
Yeah. Please. He believed he could hide this from law enforcement as they would never search an unstable mind.
Right.
Police secured the Powell home as evidence and search warrants were served on the home and family minivan. Detectives noted that nothing appeared to be missing from the residence. There were no signs of forced entry, and it didn't appear there was a robbery, home invasion, burglary, or signs of a struggle. The minivan was cluttered with clothing, blankets, and supplies, including a portable generator, a humidifier, hand tools, and a plastic tote of unopened camping supplies. Unopened camping supplies.
Why do you need a humidifier in the middle of the desert?
He doesn't want
moisture. In the center console, detectives located a pink Motorola cell phone. The detectives assumed it belonged to Susan. When asked about it, Josh appeared nervous and couldn't think of an explanation as to why her phone was in the car. He said that he must have borrowed her phone because he needed some numbers out of it and must have forgotten to return it.
But yet he called her and left voicemails on it?
And when he borrowed it, he went and sat in his car with it to get the numbers out of it.
And he didn't hear it ring when he called it?
Two plastic trash bags were found in the minivan, which struck detectives as odd. Both the garbage cans at home were empty, so clearly Josh was planning on disposing of these bags elsewhere. The first bag appeared to have come from the kitchen. It contained food from the pancake dinner with Giovanna Owing. The police theorized that Josh had poisoned or sedated Susan during the meal, so uneaten portions were set for analysis. Later, Utah State Crime Lab was unable to identify any suspicious substances. The second trash bag was hidden in a floorboard compartment containing several sheets of badly burned drywall, three short wire segments that were charred, a few small screws, a screwdriver bit, and a chunk of unidentifiable melted metal which recovered from the minivan. During a subsequent search of the Powell home, detectives also located a scorched spot on the concrete floor of the garage. In the early weeks of the investigation, police focused on trying to find Susan and determine what had happened to her. The home was searched, samples were taken from the couch, carpet, and other areas of interest, looking for blood or any DNA. Shockingly, the initial tests proved positive for blood on the couch, human blood on the couch, and floor of the Powell home. Investigators also discovered life insurance policies on Susan amounting to $1.5 million.
So in this picture, they have the couch and, like, circled where they found blood. And then here is a sample of the floor. And you see all those little circles?
Okay. Like little blood drops?
Yeah.
Okay.
And then I have this picture, which shows Simpson Springs, if you can see it. And, like, the area. And then, so this is all the supplies that were unopened. And then this is that unidentified melted mud. This is why Lacey's reading today. Melted metal.
You would think that he would be, like, smart enough to, like, melt down her cell phone.
Or leave it in the desert.
Yeah.
Or not have, like, trash bags full of evidence just chilling in his car. But
I actually wouldn't think he'd be smart enough for any of that. He's been a dummy the whole time.
I'm sure he thought that he, like, the response time wouldn't be this quick. Like, he would, like, be able
to... He underestimated how much people like her.
Yeah. He thought she could just call out of work. Did not even occur to him that the kids need to, like, go to daycare or be called out of daycare or whatever, because he never takes care of the kids. Apparently no showed at his job, which feels like it's probably just a thing he did sometimes. So
what he actually, what he did was he told police that he got Sunday and Monday confused. So he thought that December 7th was, he told police that he got the days confused. And so on Monday, he thought that he was already fired. So he didn't bother going.
Why didn't you come to work today? Didn't you fire me? No.
Didn't they have a guest over that for that dinner? Like, just so blatant.
Right. Dive back in. Yes. About 10 days prior to Susan's disappearance, police discovered that Josh had visited a welding store in South Salt Lake. At the store, Josh purchased a large welding torch capable of cutting steel. Investigators began searching the Simpson Springs area of West Desert. They found no evidence of Susan nor any evidence of camping. So, the investigators tried to confirm Josh's alibi with Simpson Spring Rangers. Surprisingly, no one could corroborate his story. In addition, the boys' clothing and their general condition were inconsistent with having spent the night outdoors in freezing temperatures. Utah's West Desert is tens of thousands of square miles of remote and rugged terrain. The search for Susan was massive, one of the largest ground searches in Utah history. Crews used ATVs, horses, cadaver dogs, and helicopters to search the area. The initial search lasted several days, but it was December. Much of the area was covered in snow. Additionally, the terrain was difficult to navigate and had countless places where someone could hide evidence or a body. Investigators called it like looking for a needle in a haystack. As I said, no physical evidence of Susan, foul play, or a camping trip were found. Though it was disappointing to come up empty-handed, the total lack of evidence convinced investigators even more that Josh's camping trip was a cover story. Meanwhile, on December 14th, Josh contacted the boys' daycare provider and indicated that the children would not be coming back and she probably would never see them again. The following day, Josh canceled all of Susan's regularly scheduled chiropractor appointments. 2 days later, he drained her IRA account. It was around this time that Charlie's church teacher spoke to authorities to report that Charlie had told her, "My mom is dead." So, real quick, what's he planning on doing with his children? Oh, never mind. I immediately didn't like the question that I was about to ask.
Real quick, just keep in mind that at this time, Josh allegedly doesn't know where Susan is.
Mm-hmm.
But he's...
He's canceling all the things. Okay.
As those events unfolded, forensics confirmed that the blood found in the Powell home belonged to Susan, although this information wasn't released to the public until 2013. What are we? We're 2009? No. Yes. Okay. Soon after, Josh hired an attorney and stopped cooperating with police. He refused polygraph tests, and he refused to let the police interview the boys. Another red flag that many found unusual in a case like this, Josh made no public pleas for Susan's return. Instead, Josh's father, Stephen Powell, publicly theorized that Susan had skipped town with a man from St. George, Utah, who apparently also disappeared from a Christmas party the same night she vanished. So his father-in-law is just like, she probably just ran out of our family.
Yeah, if you're thinking that, like, is random, it is. She's like...
I wonder if, and I don't know if we'll find out later or not, because I don't know this episode, or this case. I wonder if his father, like, genuinely thought that, if he was just such a obnoxious person, he was like, oh yeah, she probably just abandoned her family and left. Or if he was suspicious of his son, or I don't even maybe knew for sure his son had done something and is trying to like plant
seeds. It feels like you gave all the options. He either genuinely believed it, he was suspicious of his son, or he knew what happened.
There's so many other options too.
One of these for sure. I'm just saying I wonder which one it is, because I'm not sure. Okay. The little bit that I know of Steve, I don't know. Josh took his sons to Puyallup to stay with his father for the holidays. On January 6, 2010, Josh returned to Utah with his brother Michael to pack the family's belongings, indicating he was moving permanently to Puyallup. Whatever it is, it's a month later. It's less than a month. Because she went missing on December 7th. This is January 6th. He's like, we're going to pack up and move. So if my wife miraculously comes back from wherever she is, she won't even know where we are. Stupid. Stupid boy. Police began seizing more from the home, including computers, hard drives, and personal documents. I wonder, and I don't know if we'll find out or not, but like, Susan's co-workers told the police, hey, she has a secret file we're supposed to give you if something happens to her. Like, did they give that to them?
I believe. I don't think they had an actual file. I think that they were told where to find the file. And just keep reading.
Okay. The police seized Josh's laptop and found that on December 2nd, 2009, Josh was Googling information on welding. There's a lot of stuff here about welding, and I don't love that. He created a text file, which he entitled Welding Instructions. Then 2 days later, moved the document to an encrypted portion of the hard drive. Police were never able to break or bypass the encryption. He's good enough at computer stuff to, like, hide shit from the police where they know it's there, but they can't get to it.
I mean, remember in the beginning when it said he was very skilled in computers?
Yeah, it's just apparently he can't work anywhere.
My husband's a welder. Should I be concerned?
Maybe.
No, find out. If he does want to provide some insight, what can you burn? What can you burn with a welding torch? Metal? Is it strictly metal?
That.
Bones? Can you burn bones?
So, this case that we're... Hold on a second.
Can you burn bones? Ask me to burn bones. Hey, Drew.
Hi. You're doing so good.
Thank you.
Yes, I'm very happy with this. I think it's really fun because, like, I know... But I get to watch you read it, and then, like, your response to it is very exciting for me.
It is really fun. I don't know. You did a really good job of, like, scripting it out very well. I don't know if I could write a good enough script, because I put more detail in my notes than I used to, but I really like bullet point stuff.
Mm-hmm. That said, it's not hot enough to burn, like, bones.
Mm. Okay. Okay.
So it uses the electricity through the metal to melt it?
Interesting. That's very interesting. Thank you, Patrick.
So you will learn.
So you can't just like use it as like a lighter to like start like a fire or something. It would?
I will say I didn't include it because I didn't fully understand the theory because I didn't have a Patrick. But having, from what he says, the salesman who sold the welding torch to Josh, told the police and gave like the receipts. But he said that Josh seemed to not have any idea how to weld. And he recommended that he get like a starter kit, but Josh was like, no, give me the big thing. And then after Susan disappeared, the salesman theorized that perhaps Josh used the welding torch to cut open like a metal mine shaft or like gain access to it. And that's because he had, remember what he said at that Christmas party?
It's like the perfect spot to like hide a body.
Mm-hmm.
Can you do that with a welder?
If it's like a welding / cutting torch, then it uses oxygen while it uses acetylene.
He was sold an oxyacetylene tank.
And yes.
So
Hmm. All right.
Tell us more, Lacey.
Among the documents we see from the home were Susan's handwritten notes where she explicitly expressed fear of Josh. In Susan's purse, they had found a key. The key was to a safety deposit box. Inside the safety deposit box, police found a folded letter stapled around the edges addressed to Susan's family and friends with the title Last Will and Testament for Susan Powell. While reviewing the documents from the home, investigators noticed something unusual. This clue would soon shift their focus to a new person of interest. Investigators discovered documents in which Susan wrote about her fears, not only of Josh, but of her father-in-law, Steve Powell. In her own journal, Susan described her father-in-law as a pedophile who gave her inappropriate attention and seemed obsessed with her. So backing up, shortly after Susan and Josh married in April 2001, friends and family started noticing that Steve showed other pictures of her journal. Okay, hold
on. Yeah, this is her last will and testament.
I have to read one thing at a time.
Sorry.
Started noticing that Steve showed Susan an unusual amount of attention. This attention grew into an obsession. He began expressing a romantic interest in Susan around 2003 when he confessed his love for her. Following that declaration, she'd refused to speak to him for several months and asked Josh to cut off contact. He secretly photographed and recorded videos of Susan. He wrote songs, poems, and obsessive journal entries about her. He made repeated inappropriate comments and advances toward her. In one journal entry, Stephen wrote, among other things, that he offered to accept Josh and Susan into his home, and Susan would become a type of additional wife to be cared for by him.
I feel like Lacey wasn't like, ew.
What? Wait, so... I'm a pedophile.
We'll get to that later.
Oh, no. This odd and very strong obsession is allegedly why Susan and Josh moved from Washington to Utah after living with Stephen, shortly after marrying. All this information didn't fully come out until August 2011. In the meantime, in April 2010, volunteer teams from American Search Dogs joined with law enforcement at Simpson Springs to search using ground teams, ATVs, horses, and cadaver dogs. No credible evidence was found. In the summer, investigators followed a tip involving a dumpster in Saratoga Springs. They traced it to the Cedar Valley landfill and deployed cadaver dogs, which indicated a spot on the site. A trackhoe excavation turned up only animal remains and debris, not Susan's remains. Wow. My cord tickled my leg and I thought something was on me. While volunteers searched for Susan, police started looking more into Stephen Powell and actually found a friend of his who wanted to talk. Sandy Anderson was a longtime friend of Steve's, and she told the police that Steve had been obsessed with Susan for years. According to Sandy, Steve could not stop talking about Susan. That's so fucking weird. Imagine one of your father-in-laws being, like, obsessed with you sexually.
No.
He'd become infatuated with Susan shortly after the wedding. And would often speak about how great she was, how beautiful she was. Quote, he'd talk about trying to see under her clothing. Why is he talking to his... Sandy, why are you friends with this guy? Longtime friends? I would dump a longtime friend so fast if he was talking about trying to see under his daughter-in-law's clothing, see her breasts. Even back then, he had this idea that she was flirting with him. End quote. One of Stephen's co-workers told detectives that Stephen planned a camping trip to Utah shortly before Susan's disappearance. He called in sick from his job the day after she vanished and the following day and continued to send emails to colleagues while he was out. In looking into Stephen, someone else called the attention of investigators. Michael Powell, this poor woman, could not get away from these Powell men. Josh's brother had sold his Ford Taurus to a wrecking yard in Oregon shortly after Susan's disappearance. Police were able to find his car, and a cadaver dog alerted to the scent of decomposing human remains in the trunk. With deliberate care, an officer released the latch and began to lift the trunk. The lid creaked upward and revealed nothing. The trunk was swabbed for DNA, but the tests were inconclusive. When questioned, Michael was evasive. Was the whole family just... I don't know what's gonna happen! In November 2010, Josh gave an interview with the Salt Lake Tribune where he blamed Susan's family for causing her to leave. Josh maintained that his wife left on her own and described Susan as extremely unstable, and he claimed her mental illness led to her disappearance. Over the next several months, relations between the Powell and Cox families became increasingly hostile. Oh, that's so weird. Josh had cut off nearly all contact between Charlie, Braden, and the Cox family. Well, that sucks. In January 2011, Susan's parents petitioned for grandparent visitation rights while also publicly criticizing Josh. They suggested that Josh was dangerous and should not have custody of the boys. Feels right. Toward the end of August, a possible break in the case led investigators to search abandoned mine shafts near Ely, Nevada, which is more than 200 miles southwest of the family's home, but no remains are found. 2 days later, Stephen Powell and Chuck Cox got into a shouting match at a remembrance rally for Susan. Steve confronted Chuck at the rally. He called him a liar and a cyber bully. Josh said he didn't appreciate the rally being so close to his current home. He didn't appreciate the rally in remembrance of his missing wife being so close to his house.
Lacey, you have to remember, he moved from Utah to Washington to get away from his missing wife. He didn't want that shit to follow him to Washington.
Putting this in my neighborhood is not appropriate, Josh said. They're trying to push an agenda. I don't know what happened to her. There are 1,000 different theories that people need to consider in strong and serious ways.
1,000 different theories?
1,000 different theories.
Sure, he thought aliens was on that list.
Then, police in Washington executed a search warrant at Steve Powell's home. Stephen and Josh had publicly threatened to post Susan's childhood diaries to a website. Why? Who are they threatening that for and about? Drew?
They said that the diaries proved that she had a mental illness.
As a child?
Which goes back to why she ran away from the family. And
if I kept diaries as a child, you might think I had mental illness. They're going to post her. Oh my god, they're so annoying. The men were ordered not to, and to turn over any evidence they had. In September, the police raided the house to obtain the diaries, as well as any other evidence related to Susan's disappearance. Journals, emails, computer files, anything that might indicate Josh or Steve knew what happened to her. What investigators discovered went far beyond what they expected. Thousands of images and videos secretly taken by Steve of women and young girls, many of them his neighbors. Hundreds of images of Susan, including candid and voyeuristic photos taken without her knowledge, sometimes through a window or in public places. Steve's personal journals, in which he wrote obsessively about Susan, describing her in sexual terms and fantasizing about a relationship with her. Home videos where Steve recorded himself singing love songs he wrote about Susan. Sorry, this isn't funny, it's creepy, but that's so cringy. He recorded himself singing homemade love songs to her. They found more than 2,330 pages in 17 spiral notebooks detailing his love and desire for Susan.
How did Josh feel about this?
He knew that his dad was about her because they said that that's part of why they moved originally. Why would you? I mean, he is the kind of person who killed his wife, I think. So maybe that's why he'd be willing to still hang out with dad. But like, well, there were details about secretly recording her and masturbating while watching the video clips and using a handheld mirror to spy on her under a bathroom door. After this became public, Stephen gave an interview to Good Morning America. He told them that he and Susan had a history of flirting. Susan was very sexual with me. We interacted in a lot of sexual ways because Susan enjoys doing that. Gross. Gross was the author's note, but I agree. This evidence led police to arrest Steve Powell and charge him with 14 counts of voyeurism and one count of possession of child pornography on September 22nd, 2011. It was at this time that the state took custody of the boys, good shit, and placed them with their maternal grandparents, Chuck and Judy Cox. In an initial custody hearing, Josh said he was unaware of his father's interest in pornography. Despite this, pornography was an issue when Steve and Tarek were getting divorced, remember? Yeah. Pornography and the devil?
Also,
Satanism or something.
Mm-hmm. Also, Tarek said that in those divorce filings that Stephen had shared the porn with his sons. So sure. It's hard to believe.
Mm-hmm. Hold on, where am I? Oh. Despite this, Josh was court-ordered to undergo a series of evaluations conducted by Dr. James Manley, a psychologist. Dr. Manley determined that Josh had adequate parenting skills, a steady employment history, and no criminal record of domestic violence. I know he didn't have a steady employment history. And I am not a psychologist. However, it was noted that Josh had issues admitting personal shortcomings. He was overbearing with his sons, and he was persistently defensive and paranoid. Josh was found to have narcissistic traits, paranoid tendencies, and poor impulse control. He was described as having inappropriate boundaries, particularly regarding the children's privacy. Dr. Manley recommended that Josh have visitation with the son several times a week, supervised by a social worker. Meanwhile, authorities in Utah resumed a large-scale search near Topaz Mountain, over 130 miles from West Valley City. This involved multiple law enforcement agencies, ground teams, ATVs, horses, aerial surveillance, and cadaver dogs combing a rugged desert area. Cadaver dogs initially alerted to signs of human remains, but subsequent digging revealed only charred wood fragments, no DNA evidence of Susan. In early 2012, Utah police notified Washington police that they discovered about 400 images of simulated child pornography, bestiality, and incest on a computer seized from the Powell home. The computer was later determined to belong to Josh. The images, while not illegal due to them being in a hand-drawn or cartoonish 3D format, were cause for great concern to Dr. Manley. Joshua was recommended to receive a more thorough psychosexual evaluation and polygraph test, but Dr. Manley suggested no change in the visitation schedule with the Powell children. Wasn't there, like, an SVU episode or something about, like, child porn? Because they were using, like, computer-generated images, so they were like, we're not actually using children, and it was like a whole thing about whether or not it was legal. I feel like that's an actual thing.
Yeah.
On Sunday, February 5th, 2012, Elizabeth Griffin Hall arrived at the... I don't like the way you wrote that whole date out. That's a something's going to happen on this day writing. Day of the week, month, date, year.
Like December 7th that you repeated multiple times, like,
This is about 3 years after she's gone missing.
Yeah, I feel like you're stalling. Right, this is stalling.
Joshua Powell with Charlie and Braden for a supervised visit. The visit was scheduled to last 3 hours at Josh's home. Shortly after arriving, at around 12:08, Elizabeth was on the phone with 911. She told the dispatcher, "I'm on a supervised visitation for a court order visit and something really weird has happened. The kids went into the house, and the parent, the biological parent, whose name is Josh Powell, will not let me in the door. What should I do?" How did they get in there without... Well, I guess they might have just walked in for whatever. The dispatcher was kind of a dick. He asked for the address, and when Elizabeth said she didn't really know, he said, "Well, that's kind of important for me to know." Elizabeth apologized and said she'd go get the address from her car. While she looked for the address, she told dispatch, nothing like this has ever happened before, these visitations, so I'm really shocked. And I could hear one of the kids crying, but he still wouldn't let me in. I think I need help right away. He's on a very short leash with DSHS, and CPS has been involved, and this is the craziest thing. He looked right at me and closed the door. After giving the address, Elizabeth told dispatch that she smelled gasoline. Then confusion ensued. As Elizabeth tried to describe her job and her purpose for being at the house, the dispatcher spent over a minute trying to figure out if she was a supervisor or the Who fucking cares, dude? And who the visitation was for. Eventually, they cleared things up, and Elizabeth told dispatch that the boys were walking a step in front of her. As soon as they walked through the door, Josh slammed the door in her face, locking her outside. 5 minutes later, she called 911. After being on the phone for about 7 minutes, the dispatcher told her police would be there, but they have to respond to emergency life-threatening situations first. Elizabeth responded that this could be life-threatening. I'm afraid for their lives. The dispatcher told her...
Stop reading ahead.
The dispatcher told her the first available deputy would be out and the call disconnected. At around 12:16, Elizabeth called 911 back. He blew up the house and the kids. On February 5th, 2012, On February 5th, 2012, Joshua Powell murdered his sons, 7-year-old Charlie and 5-year-old Braden, in an apparent planned double murder-suicide. Autopsies revealed all three Powells had died of carbon monoxide poisoning. However, both Charlie and Braden had what the medical examiner referred to as significant chopping injuries to the head and neck. Deemed not immediately fatal, the ME said these injuries would have been incapacitating. After the fire had been extinguished, deputies recovered a hatchet from the rubble of the house next to the bodies. What was even the point of that if he was going to blow it up anyway?
I think to incapacitate them.
Also among the rubble, investigators found multiple gasoline cans inside the house. These deaths required little investigation. The evidence was clear. The day before the visit, Josh had withdrawn around $7,000 from his bank account. Why? Donated the boys' toys and books to local charities and visited his storage unit. Minutes before the incident, he sent goodbye emails to his family and friends. Some of them received instructions in the emails for where to find his money and how to shut off his utilities. Joshua named his brother Michael as the main beneficiary of his life insurance policy. Evidence shows that Josh had dosed the house in gasoline prior to the arrival of his sons, deliberately pouring extra near the entryway and living room. Then, after locking Elizabeth outside, he incapacitated Charlie and Braden with a hatchet, then he lit the house on fire.
Do you need a second, Lacey?
No, I want to get through it.
Okay.
When authorities notified Stephen, who was in jail at the time, he didn't seem very upset by the news, but was angry towards authorities who notified him. Somebody chopped Stephen in the neck. 2 weeks later, Stephen invoked... Oh my god, look at the house. Holy shit. 2 weeks later, Stephen invoked his Fifth Amendment right not to answer questions regarding Susan's disappearance. Charles and Braden are buried at Woodbine Cemetery in Puyallup, Washington, which also contains a memorial for their mother. More than 1,000 people mourn the deaths of Charlie and Braden at a public funeral held about a week after their deaths in Tacoma. Joshua's remains were cremated. The dispatcher was reprimanded afterwards for allowing 22 minutes to pass before help arrived. Dispatcher David violated 4 policies of his handling of the call. Mainly, he didn't assign the call a priority that indicated an imminent danger to life or property. I feel like anytime this was a domestic situation, you've got a non-custodial parent refusing to allow authorities to get to their children. That should immediately be like a warning.
He just got reprimanded. Like, he didn't, like, why can't we charge him?
I don't know. I think listening to the 911 call, it seemed like he got hung up on the stupidest details and he just would not, like, let it go. Like, when I tell you that they, for over a minute, discussed, like, who was the supervisor, who was the supervisee, who were the kids there to visit.
It feels like information you should get after you are like, okay, the police are on their way. While that's happening, let me get all this other
information. Yeah. Also, it's like knowing what is happening while he is nitpicking over that.
Yeah.
Is so frustrating, especially because like 1 minute doesn't sound like a lot of time, but knowing what was going on. And then the other thing is, like, he was such a dick. He sounded impatient and was just fed up with Elizabeth. I'm going to need to know the address. But, okay, you don't have to be an asshole about it. Like,
nobody thinks about it every day.
Mm-hmm.
About a week later, a recycling center was searched after it was discovered that Josh had visited the facility the day before he killed himself and his sons. Volunteers combed through more than 10 tons of paper and eventually found a testament with Josh's name on it, some paperback books with Susan's name on them, and a map of Utah. Josh Powell's storage unit in Washington was searched, and investigators made an interesting discovery. A comforter inside the unit tested positive for blood in a presumptive test. In addition to the comforter, authorities took 2 plastic bins with miscellaneous items, a box with blocks, a white garbage bag filled with children's clothes and linens, another bag with toys, and framed photos from the storage unit. Most of those items were handed over to relatives. In May 2012, Steve's trial began. He pleaded not guilty to all charges. Prosecutors decided to narrow the case to voyeurism charges involving 2 neighbor girls, ages 8 and 10, who Steve had filmed through their bathroom window while they bathed. The child pornography charges were dropped before trial due to the judge ruling the evidence was not sexually explicit. It doesn't need to be sexually explicit. If you're recording naked children aren't your kids that you're recording for fun because they're a baby getting their first bath, it's child porn.
My thing is, like, you might not think it's sexually explicit, which is he good. Did.
Yeah.
But how do we know he didn't?
Right.
Why else would he be recording it?
Steve's attorneys claimed the images were not illegal and did not, imagine being that kind of a defense attorney, and did not constitute voyeurism under Washington law. On June 13th, Steve was found guilty on all 14 counts of voyeurism after 6.5 hours of deliberation. Steve, who was 62 at the time, was facing up to 5 years in prison for each of the 14 counts. Prosecutors asked the judge to sentence Steve to 10 years in prison. Steve's defense asked for a sentence of 0 to 12 months in jail, noting that the pictures could have been taken before the state ranked voyeurism a felony in 2006. It also argued that, though the pictures were inappropriate, Powell never left his home or interacted with the girls. They got lucky. I imagine he would have worked up to it.
Yeah. Well, he was so hung up on, what was it, Susan?
Yeah.
The picture, I was thinking that if her husband didn't kill her, because I'm sure he fucking did, with or without his father's help, she probably would have been in danger from her father-in-law in a couple years.
Yeah.
The pictures were alleged to have been taken from Steve's bedroom window, which faced the bathroom of the girl's home. In the end, the judge sentenced Stephen Powell to 30 months for 2.5 years in prison. In 2013, the DNA results from the blood at the Powell home were released to the public. One blood sample was matched to Susan, while another sample was determined to have come from an unknown male contributor. On February 11, 2013, Michael Powell killed himself by jumping from the roof of a parking garage. After Susan's disappearance, estate, life insurance policies, and marital property were in a state of limbo. After Josh's death, a bit of tug-of-war ensued between the Cox family and the Powell family over who would control Susan's estate. The Powell family can fuck right off.
Yeah.
Chuck Cox petitioned the court to declare Susan legally dead so he could be appointed the executor of the estate. At the time, Terica Powell, oh, that's disappointing, and Josh's sister Alina were claiming a right to Susan's assets and money. The Powell family argued that there was no definitive proof that Susan was dead. I hate so many people in the story. They wanted to maintain control over her estate. In 2015, a Utah court declared Susan legally dead, listing the date of death as December 6, 2009. Chuck was made a conservator over her estate. He made changes, effectively cutting out the Powell family. Chuck and his wife, Judy, filed a wrongful death lawsuit against Washington State's Department of Social and Health Services, claiming that the state failed to protect Charlie and Braden during visitation. Erica and Josh's sister, Alina, tried to intervene in the lawsuit, arguing that the Cox family was blaming the entire Powell family. This isn't about you. The court allowed the wrongful death suit to proceed, and in 2020, a jury awarded the Cox family $98.5 million in damages. In May 2013, West Valley City Police officially suspended active investigation, stating their conclusion that Josh Powell likely killed her and disposed of her body with the help of his brother, Michael. Since then, there have been no publicly documented uses of ground-penetrated radar or aerial surveillance in the case. However, in May 2019, a private search focused on Simpson Springs. Still no trace of Susan has ever been found. In 2014, the Washington State Court of Appeals reversed the ruling that the images from Stephen Powell were not considered child porn due to not being sexually explicit. Stephen Powell was arrested again and stood trial on child pornography charges. Hold on, I just want to see what year it was that he was convicted. 12. So it was only 2 years later. He was convicted in 2015 and sentenced to 5 years in prison. With good behavior, he was released from prison in July 2017. Why do you get good behavior if you, like...
Yeah, it's not hard to have good behavior when your victims aren't around you.
There's no children in jail. Steve was hospitalized for heart complications in July 2018 and died at the age of 68 on July 23rd. Detectives were monitoring his condition daily in hopes of speaking with him about the case of his daughter-in-law. They were really hoping to get a deathbed confession. For years, the unidentified melted metal collected from the Powell's minivan was thought to be a cell phone, a GPS unit, or hard drive. An experiment run by Cold Podcast disproved that theory. In 2019, Cold performed another experiment and found that when they subjected a rigid impact driver to high heat from a cutting torch, the results bore a strong resemblance to the metal collected from the minivan. With the death of Stephen Powell, investigators are concerned they might never find out what happened to Susan Cox Powell. Today, Susan's disappearance is still officially an open case. The Cox family continues to hope that someone somewhere will come forward with information that could bring her home. But with every year that passes, and with the deaths of Josh, Michael, and Stephen, the chances of finding Susan or getting justice grow smaller.
Good job, Lacey.
Thanks for that one.
Why'd you kill your kid?
Right. So aside from him being who he was as a person and everything, Nobody gained anything from the kids being killed. That is, like, strictly a nobody gets the kids.
I think it was a control thing.
Yeah. Nobody can. Right. He knows that her parents wanted them, and he was like, well, fuck you guys, then. I'm going to kill my kids instead of letting you have them.
He had lost custody. Yeah. So in this picture, the brown background is what they got from the van. The white is what that podcast experimented on. So you can kind of see how it looks very similar.
And they said it was a rigid impact driver.
Rigid is like the brand.
Yeah.
I don't know what an impact driver is.
It's a tool, but I don't know what the significance would be.
Just like a drill, Pat said.
Yeah. I don't know what the significance would be for like a missing person's thing.
Yeah. So, I mean, I don't know about you guys. I definitely think Josh killed her. Yeah. My question is, like, so the police said that they found no evidence of camping, clearly because he didn't camp. And the boys didn't look like they'd been outside. So where did he go all night?
I feel like he probably went. My thought is, and I'm just stringing this together right now, because I had kind of forgotten about his brother's car, like the cadaver dogs alerting or whatever, mm-hmm. until toward the end when they said that the brother killed himself. But I feel like they said they thought that he drugged her food, but then they tested the food and nothing came back positive for it. But then there was blood in the house. I don't know if he killed her before they left the house or just incapacitated her in some way, but I think he probably went much further than just wherever he said he was camping and had either called his brother in a panic to meet him there or like had it planned out or whatever. I just think that he drove really far.
I think so too.
And they buried her somewhere, or they made a fire and burned her and buried her. I just think it wasn't where he told them he was camping.
I don't think that he took the boys outside of the van at all.
Yeah.
I think the boys probably fell asleep.
Yeah.
But like the fact that they found like, they alerted to human remains in the trunk.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder if, like, he met up with Michael somewhere and transferred the body to his car, and Michael disposed of it.
Yeah.
And then
he just needed to stay out all night, because maybe he planned on the camping being his alibi, even though it was stupid. So he was like, well, I have to stay away all night to make it look like
we were camping. That really didn't sound plan, though. Because why would... You have to know that if you want a story to be plausible, you don't take your two young kids out of bed at midnight to take them camping 2 hours away. You got to know that that's going to sound suspicious. I think that that's just the time that he left the house, mm-hmm. and he knew that he needed a cover story as to why he left the house.
Remember, when somebody finally got a hold of him when they were calling, the cell phone thing showed that he was already in town. So we don't actually know how long he'd been back in town for. It could have been hours that he was hanging out in a parking lot somewhere.
Mm-hmm. With his phone off.
Did you say something about seeing their mom out there with them, too?
One of them said something about...
Charlie, the older one.
Or whatever.
He said that they all went out, but mom stayed behind where the crystals are.
And we don't have any idea what that means.
But I think it's definitely strange that Michael killed himself.
Yeah.
Like, if there was any question about whether or not he was involved, I think the fact that he committed suicide.
Yeah.
Pretty.
And wasn't he the one that Josh, like, left his money and shit to?
Mm-hmm. But, so Alina, his sister... She was the one who was like, Susan was always flirting with my dad. And I warned him that she was playing a game and he needed to watch himself and not, like, catch feelings. But, like, it was a game to her.
It sounds like these kids are all rotten.
They're all fucked up.
However, Jennifer, the oldest sister, who is often described as Josh's estranged sister, was, like, really good friends with Susan and was like, no. I mean, she told the police that Josh was cleaning when she picked up the kids. Like, she has no...
Yeah.
She didn't like him. And I think that she was like...
I mean, it probably also all goes back to, like, how that household was run and that...
Yeah. She did say... I'm going to misquote her, but she did tell, like, people that she genuinely believed that Josh did something to Susan.
Yeah.
Josh's mother thinking she had any right to Susan's money and shit is fucking bonkers.
Yeah. I don't know what Tarika was thinking, because you thought that she was, like, just another victim.
She was a sympathetic character early on.
Yeah. And then she started being... Well, I think that she started getting defensive, because despite the fact that her son sucks, it is her son.
Mm-hmm. And her grandkid.
Yeah. And...
I don't know. You could be my child, but if you, like, kill my grandbabies, you're... Yeah.
Yeah, and I could understand her still being, like, the grief of losing her child and her grandkids and stuff, but, like, so did Susan's parents.
Well,
and as far as they all know, he killed her. So them trying to claim what was Susan's.
During the, like, court stuff, Tarika's attorney was like, Tarika is really grieving. And, like, she lost two sons, Michael and Josh, two grandsons, and a daughter-in-law. Okay. And I was like, yeah, but it wasn't like someone took them from you.
No, your sons made their decision. Your grandchildren, your daughter-in-law were taken from you.
Yeah, I think that if your one son didn't suck so much, they would all be alive.
And it must be very difficult trying to, like, navigate the emotion of losing your son, but also your son was such an awful person that mm-hmm. he killed his wife and your grandchildren. Like, I don't know how you figure out how to cope with that, but I think the first step is not being a dick and trying to take the other, like, the shit that should go to the other grandparents.
I think also, that was
a wild thing for her to try to fight for.
Two more things. The podcast that was running experiments on that stuff, they, I believe, later came out after having done some, like, research or whatever, and they found that those files that were on Josh's computer of, like, the animated pornography, they found that that had been, like, the laptop was secondhand, and that had been on the laptop before Josh purchased it, and it was never accessed after he purchased it. So there's that. Also, looking at the case now, law enforcement have a hard time understanding why back then Josh was never charged. Yes, there was no body.
But you had circumstantial evidence.
Yeah, there was a lot of evidence that suggested that he had something to do, at least, with Susan's disappearance.
Like, people have been put away for less.
Right. And maybe if he was arrested for it and they convinced him that they could get him in jail and offered him some kind of a deal, maybe he would have given up information and they would have known what happened to Susan.
Or, Lacey, if they had arrested him, he would not have had the opportunity to kill himself or his baby boys.
Well, yeah. Yeah, that would be good.
Yeah. Sorry that I kind of snuck that up on you, Lacey.
Snuck it up on me.
Yeah, I don't think you were ready for it, and I'm sorry.
Once you told, like, brought up that, like,
the date.
No, the social worker getting locked out. I was like, I remember this.
Yeah.
I knew something was coming with them, but I guess I just wasn't thinking that, like, I'm going to think about what it might be because I was busy reading.
Also, can we talk about the psychiatrist who is like, oh, he's not in danger. He has a steady, like, living situation.
And then after they found the porn stuff on the laptop, which now they're saying wasn't his. Okay, they didn't know that then.
Yeah.
They were like, well, this is concerning. Let him keep spending time with his kids.
Yeah.
Let's get him evaluated. But in the meantime, give him access to the boys.
Well, it was supervised visits.
I hope a bunch of people lost their jobs.
Shouldn't be supervised if you're able to, like, slam the door and something.
Yeah.
Okay. Supervised visits should have been the kids are at a location, like some kind of a family center, and he goes there.
Yeah. I will say, I am glad that those three men, Michael, Stephen, and Josh, are dead.
God. Yeah.
Yeah.
Is he making
that was sinister.
We were sarcastic.
And we hope you keep listening.